versus Brinkman Cornell. Mr. Cassara, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Scarpati, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning. Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, Chief Judge, I've asked to reserve 3 minutes for my rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honor, my name is William Cassara, and along with Captain Robert Duffy, we represent the appellant in this case, Alberto Brinkman Cornell. The court has granted review of two assignments of error.
Mr. Cassara, can you speak up just a little bit? You know how we old folks are.
Yes, sir. Is that better, Judge?
That is.
You may want to move the microphone a little bit more towards you.
I'm usually told that I'm too loud. Not loud enough. But
okay. I'll let you know if that happens.
Chief Judge, I've granted review on two assignments of error in this case. I would like to take them chronologically with the court's permission. In assignment of error one, the military judge erred when he failed to recuse himself from appellant's court-martial for the appearance of bias. Quick summary of the facts in this case. The military judge was the special victims prosecutor in this exact same jurisdiction immediately prior to appellant's trial and at the time of the alleged offenses. He was, by his own calling, the self-professed subject matter expert for all of Hawaii for sex crimes, including sexual assault and child pornography. He participated directly in cases under the umbrella of what's called Operation Kiki Shield or Keiki Shield. I'm not sure exactly how it's pronounced, but we'll call it OKS. And he mentored the trial counsels in this same case. This all leads to the appearance of impropriety and the appearance of bias. Critical for this court's decision today is that the military judge never mentioned or made any reference at all to Rule for Court-Martial 902A. Therefore, this court should give his findings little deference.
Mr. Cassara, can I break this down into
Please.
Component parts here? Is it the combination of the two, the being the expert and knowing the parties, that results, in your view, in the necessary disqualification? Or could it have been simply the fact that he was subject matter expert?
I view those as three different things, but I think it is the combination of those three things. The fact that he was a special victims prosecutor, the fact that he is the self-professed subject matter expert on this specific type of crime in this specific jurisdiction, and that he mentored the trial counsel.
So it's cumulatively.
Correct.
So you're saying if someone is just a subject matter expert, that is not disqualifying.
I think every case would be unique, but I think in this particular case, the being a subject matter expert on a topic in general would not necessarily be disqualifying. I do have grave concerns, candidly, about being the subject matter expert in this jurisdiction with this particular subject matter. In other words, for example, let us say that this military judge had been a special victims prosecutor in Europe for 2 years prior to this. My argument would be different. And I know Judge Sparks is fond of asking me, which is your weakest and which is your strongest argument? My argument would be weaker if he had been the subject matter expert in another jurisdiction, or if he had mentored trial counsel in sexual assault crimes in a different jurisdiction, or if he had been in this jurisdiction and had been a trial counsel and had made. But when you put three of those together, it creates a very significant appearance of impropriety in the appellant's belief.
Counsel, can you say a little bit more about Operation Keiki Shield? In your reply brief, you suggest that the military judge knew what this operation was, or members of the public would think that he knew it or had inside views of it. And can you just elaborate? Like, we don't really have much information about Operation Keiki Shield. What would a member of the public think based on knowing that he had worked with the police who had been involved in this?
So, Your Honor, in terms of what we know or don't know, I think that there's two important parts to that. One of those is the military, you know, ACCA says, well, the military judge was forthcoming when he said this. Well, that's partially true, but there's also this part where the military judge only said gave a little bit more intimation about what he had done upon the prodding of the defense counsel. Now, a direct answer to your question, what we do know about OKS is that he had trained, mentored these trial counsel, he had worked with CID, that this was a joint CID, Honolulu Police Department venture geared towards a very noble cause, capturing child predators on the island of Hawaii. We know that he was, you know, when he called himself the subject matter expert, clearly he had intimate knowledge of how Operation Keiki Shield worked. So that is what we know from the record. And what that where the concern on that lies, and where we believe that the military judge abused his discretion, is that he failed to consider important facts, and therefore his ruling was arbitrary and clearly unreasonable. This is not an issue, and here's the important distinction that I think needs to be made in this case. It's not an issue of your typical military judge's career progression. You're a trial counsel, you're a defense counsel, you may be a chief of justice, and then you ascend to the bench. And there are cases in which that has happened, and a military judge either ascends to a bench in a different jurisdiction, or ascends to the bench in the same jurisdiction after a brief respite of time, for lack of a better term. But the primacy of his involvement in this specific type of case and in this specific operation immediately prior to his assuming the bench creates the risk of injustice. And using the three-part test from Lilleberg, it creates a risk of injustice to the appellant. This was a judge-alone case. Military judge was required to make credibility determinations on witnesses and the operation itself and CID agents. The military judge ruled on motions to suppress, the motion to suppress that we'll talk about in just a few seconds, and on Rule 404B motions.
So, Mr. Casera, we're looking at what a member of the public would think about this. Sometimes members of the public can be somewhat naive about what goes on in our courtrooms. What if the member of the public, this hypothetical member of the public, is informed that in local and state courts across the country that you may very well have a prosecutor who is the chief of the violent crime unit, worked very closely with law enforcement. They take the bench. Sometimes they're elected to those positions, and they immediately start adjudicating cases where people from the local prosecutor's office and police officers are coming in and testifying. If a member of the public is told, this is historically what happens in this country, this is how it works, and there is the assumption that when a judge dons his or her black robes, that he becomes or she becomes neutral and detached. Should that figure into how this court looks at how a member of public should do it, or should that not be something?
I do not believe it does, and here's why, Judge. The case law in Lilleberg talks about a reasonable member of the public. Those two terms may be contradictory, but it talks about a reasonable member of the public. And the case law in Lilleberg and other cases says military justice is different. And when you're looking at your average small-town prosecutor, that's one thing. When you are talking about a command-driven process, such as the military justice system, it's different. And in that regard, a reasonable member of the public, seeing that the subject matter expert in this jurisdiction who mentored these trial counsels then sits as a judge over one of the cases that occurred while he was doing those three things, would believe that this process is unfair.
So even if we were to adopt your view that there is an important, meaningful distinction between a command-driven process, as you say, how does the role of the judge, of a trial judge, differ in the military as compared to local court?
Well, I don't know that once you're in the courtroom that's a distinction with that much of a difference. I have a tremendous amount of respect for our trial judges, and I think that they try and they usually do the right thing. But in this particular case, the perception from a reasonable member of the public would just say, you know what, this stinks and this should not have happened.
Counsel, in your reply, if you criticize the government for sort of saying, showing that how actual bias was not there, that they've been looked in, and you said, well, that's fine, but this is a case about the appearance of impropriety. But doesn't eliminating actual bias weigh substantially into the question of whether there is an appearance? In other words, having looked into this and seen, even though he was there at some of the time that the cases were coming up, he didn't participate in this case, that he had walled himself off, doesn't that help eliminate the appearance of bias? I mean, is there no relationship between the actual bias once that's excluded and the appearance of bias?
I think that they can be correlative. As you know, we argued actual bias before the Army Court. We have not argued it before this Court because we believe that the appearance of bias in this case is so strong that this Court need not look towards actual bias. Your Honors, moving on to assignment of error.
So can I just ask, though, is there a standard that we can set, or are you saying every case rises and falls on the specific facts? There is no real standard. We need to simply stand where we have been in terms of what a member of public would think.
Judge, I would love for the trial judiciary to enact a rule that says a special victims prosecutor should not go straight to the bench after working in the same jurisdiction. I think that would be a wonderful policy rule. I don't believe it's something that this Court can or should do.
Judge Johnson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chief Judge. I just want to go back. I know you're going to move to Issue 2, but in enunciating the standard for the abuse of discretion, you argued that he failed to consider important facts. What are those important facts? Because you're saying that because of that, then we should give his decision less deference.
This Court should give his decision less deference because, A, he did not put his findings on the record in terms of 902 Alpha.
Okay.
He talked about he was going to have a conversation with the Chief Judge. We don't know if that ever happened. He never put that on the record. So there are important facts that are missing that we just don't know.
Okay. All right.
In terms of assignment of
error. Counsel, I have one more before you move on.
So
it sounds like that you believe that the Army placed the military judge in a very impossible position, right, by not moving him to another base, by leaving him in the same jurisdiction, that given the way our dockets look with sexual assault crimes, that he was, even though he was diligent about keeping track of all the cases that he worked on, that he knew about, that he cross-referenced the appellant's name across that list to see whether he had a conflict of interest, that nevertheless, despite of all those precautions, that he was just in an impossible position, having formally, given his work history, and is that essentially your position?
Yes.
Okay.
Moving on to assignment of error 2, the military judge abused his discretion when he denied the motion to suppress evidence discovered in the appellant's vacuum phone and all derivative evidence. When I thought about what I was going to argue before this case, I was going to get up and just read Judge Hayes' dissenting opinion, but the Court can do that on his own. But as Judge Hayes said, forensic evaluation and exigent circumstances are mutually exclusive subjects. That is the gravamen of the argument in this case. Now, given my time constraints, Your Honor, I'm going to sort of skip through some of the facts that we had argued and move on to the argument or some of the facts that we had laid out. The Court knows what the facts of the case are. After the appellant was apprehended and his commander goes to his house and CID goes to his house, they seize what is called, for an older person like myself, Judge Barks, I won't make any references, but, you and I have had this joke about technological advances. I thought vacuum phone was some sort of fancy type of phone. It's not. It was a phone in a vacuum. And they find the phone, and the first thing that they do, they say that they're on this mad search for a missing person search, and they're going to go out and find this person, and they put the phone on mute or on airplane mode to where no incoming and outgoing calls can be found. They then set the phone up for what is called the most sound forensic analysis that they can do. And they then put the phone in a room and for 3 hours, it sits for 3 hours, and then the guy goes home. That's Judge Hayes' dissenting opinion. He calls it a night and goes home. All of while they are allegedly on a manhunt and a madman hunt for somebody that the commander believes may be suicidal. put the phone in airplane mode to preserve it. This prevented any incoming calls, text, or notifications. What did they not do? They did not search his Google sites. They did not search his calendar. They did not search hotel reservations, which would have shown them where he was. Instead, CID collects the phone and sends it to the evidence room so that the defense forensic examiner could search in the most forensically sound manner. Forensic examiner in the most forensically sound manner in a time when they are allegedly looking for somebody who they believe may be potential of self-harm.
And the phone Counsel, are you conceding that they had authority then? If they had taken actions that were more consistent with what you think they should have been doing to look for signs of life, do you concede that they would have had authority to do that?
If your question is, do I believe that he gave his husband consent and that consent was not rescinded, the answer is no, I do not believe that. I do not believe that he gave consent because, A, the husband did not own the phone. So you can't have, ACCA talks about mutual ownership of the phone. The husband didn't even know the phone existed. You can't mutually own something that you don't know exists. The ACCA decision talks about the fact that the ACCA court does not talk about, rather, the fact that they had separate phone accounts. So I would argue that, A, he did not give consent to search the phone because it was not something over which, and this is the Black decision from last term, in which the court says, well, if there's mutual ownership, but in this case there was not mutual ownership, or if there was a clear grant of authority. And in this case, not only did the husband say, he told me to disregard my prior instructions to go into the phone, but I didn't know about this phone, and there was no co-ownership of the phone. Judge Sparks?
Yeah, I was going to say, that goes to the apparent authority issue. Goes to the actual authority issue. What about the apparent authority issue that you've raised? I mean, isn't that viewed from the perspective of the investigators?
I was talking really fast there, Judge.
So yeah, you were. That's why.
Yeah,
I was.
Sorry. No, there was no apparent authority in this case because any authority obtained by CID was as a result of the false information that CID portrayed to the husband in an effort to get him to give permission to search the phone. I want it to be clear, Judge. We believe that this entire thing was a subterfuge by CID. They knew he had been arrested. They knew what he had been arrested for. They had his primary phone in the evidence room. They put this phone on airplane mode so that they could not reach him and he could not reach them.
But at some point, maybe you don't agree, but it seems that a genuine issue arose concerning the whereabouts, not just whereabouts of the the appellant, but what he that he may have caused himself harm. So there's a life-saving kind of issue involved. Somewhere along the way that arose, and it appears to have been a genuine concern, since we now know afterwards he did in fact try to harm himself.
Your Honor, respectfully, if it were a genuine concern, CID would have kept the phone on. They would have looked in his Google calendar. They would have looked at his hotel reservations. They would have looked at his bank accounts.
But is the question the fact that they could have done more, does that mean necessarily that what they did do was unreasonable? Because under the Fourth Amendment, we're talking about reasonableness or unreasonableness, right?
No, and this Court has said it doesn't have to be an optimum search. And the Army Court said that this was not an optimum search. They came to the conclusion that it was still an emergency search. I simply disagree.
May I ask you this question, Mr. Cassara? If the facts were different, if in fact appellant's husband did have common authority, would the actions of CID here been improper?
No, because the authority had been withdrawn when he said disregard. So, for example.
But I'm saying different facts. I'm saying in a case where there is, in fact, common authority, and the husband turns over the phone, is there anything that CID did then that was improper?
improper in sense, well, and Chief Judge, I'm not trying, I'm going to make sure I understand.
That would
the
defeat
question.
The prosecution.
I'm sorry, say again.
That would defeat the prosecution of this case.
With all due respect, I think I'm trying to split hairs in my brain that I can't split, because I can't differentiate between what they knew and what they did.
Well, I'm trying to tie it back to the point that was raised by Judge Sparks in terms of, as I understood it, was there reasonable reliance on the part of CID here? And if there was reasonable reliance, I understand your point that it is, shall we say, highly strange that they would put the phone on airplane mode. But what would that mean if the husband had common authority?
Okay.
And therefore, what does it mean if there was reasonable reliance by law enforcement believing that he had common authority?
So assuming arguendo that the husband had common authority, then I think CID could have gone and applied for another search authorization once they had seen the thumbnail images in the phone. And then it would be up to a magistrate, and maybe we're having a different argument as to whether or not the magistrate had probable cause to believe. But had they...
So the husband saying, do whatever you need to do to find my husband, that isn't giving carte blanche.
No, because, I mean, you wouldn't look in a jewelry box for his husband. If they had opened up a jewelry box and found a stash of cocaine, we would say, well, that's not, you're not looking for his husband.
But isn't that a pretty tenuous analogy here, a jewelry box as compared to a phone with all this data in it, where if in the hypothetical, husband says, I have, and he's correct, I have common authority over this phone. It's joint ownership. We use it all the time. Here you go, CID. Do anything you want with this phone. What I care about is finding my husband.
Then we are having a very different discussion. I agree. We are having a very different discussion.
So that ties into the reasonable reliance. If CID believes, based on the fact that the husband knew the whereabouts of the phone, he had the passcode of the phone, and turns it over, then what were the limitations on CID at that point?
And the problem that I'm having with the Chief Judge's question is, when you say, if CID believed this, I don't know of, and Judge Hayes said, you know, in his last sentence of his dissent, I don't know of anything that could be more unreasonable than what they said that they believed in this case. So respectfully, I can't make the quantum leap of if this was a reasonable action on CID's behalf, because it just wasn't. So I would have to disagree with the Chief Judge on that point.
May I ask one last question?
Absolutely.
Could you address the disregard message? I mean, it seems that there is more than one way to interpret that. You're suggesting is whatever authority I gave you, disregard it. I'm withdrawing all authority. That's not the way the military judge interpreted it. And do we have to use the military judge's interpretation unless we find it clearly erroneous?
No. And I think that when you look at the four sort of edicts that he said, do this, do this, do this, do this, then he says disregard all of that, for lack of a better term. I find it hard to make the quantum leap of disregard means anything beyond disregard.
Well, so you're suggesting that the military judge was just clearly erroneous here?
Yes.
But you're not challenging the standard. We're not reviewing this de novo.
You are not no, in fact, I think the case law is pretty clear. You look at the military judge's decision, and then you look at ACCA's interpretation of what the military judge did.
But don't we have case law that says there has to be a, quote, clear rescission? I can't find the case right now, but I believe that's the wording in our precedent, saying there has to be a clear rescission.
I would argue that, A, disregard is about as clear as you can get, and, B, this Court has said frequently, we're not looking for magic talismanic words. We're looking to convey the message. The message was, I told you to do this, disregard.
But counsel didn't – the husband even ignored that. I mean, the husband did not disengage after the disregard. He called him back because the first message was so frantic. So if the husband – disregarded the disregard notice, why is it unreasonable to think that, no, it was not this blanket stand down, don't do anything, whatever, and that the military judge would have erred by concluding that the disregard was not just the total prohibition against doing anything further.
Judge Johnson, when we look at what the husband did or did not do, he did not fly to Hawaii. He did not call anybody in Hawaii to say, hey, can you go check on Adalberto? He did not go find the car keys. All of the things that he was told to do and then told disregard, he disregarded. Subject to any further questions?
I see none.
Thank you, members
of
the
board. Captain Scarpati.
My apologies. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Tony Scarpati, and I, along with Colonel Richard Guarini, represent the United States. Before I even jump into my roadmap, I just do want to answer a few questions that the argument tailed off.
Captain Costa, can you speak up just a little?
Yes, Your Honor, my apologies.
I have the same problem I had. It isn't your problem.
Yes, sir. No problem, sir. So I would like to just address a few of the questions from the court before I even launch into my roadmap. Firstly, Your Honor, the case that you were referring to is United States v. Eugene, and it talks about a clear intent and an unequivocal statement. The disregard message here was not that. And that, in part, is based on a finding of fact, and that goes to your question, Judge Maggs. You would have to find that the military judge's findings were clearly erroneous, but the problem is they were not. And the standard here is not simply whether this court would disagree, but whether the military judge abuses discretion in making these findings of fact. These findings of fact were supported by the record, supported by the witnesses, and supported by the AIRs, which were created close in time to these events. And I would just direct this court briefly to that evidence on, for example, the record JA-59, where Cap testified, and the agents testifying, especially on JA-73 to 83 and 121 to 126. Additionally, to the AIRs, Your Honor, and that is JA-406, JA-410, and JA-315. And you'll see in those AIRs and through the agent's testimony that here there was a multi-agent mass effort made in good faith to locate appellant.
This would you say good faith?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that fit with placing the phone in airplane mode?
Yes,
if you had a runaway teenager and the parent hands over the phone and law enforcement puts it on airplane mode where it cannot receive any incoming calls from friends and so forth who might have had last knowledge of the whereabouts of this person, that would be extraordinary. So why is it here when it's CID is claiming they're searching for someone whose phone they have and they say, we put it on airplane mode. Why shouldn't that, consistent with what Judge Hayes said at the CCA, cause you to think this is one big subterfuge?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think there's a variety of factors. First, I would point out that CID is still law enforcement. So even if they are looking for appellant and doing their best to find them, they still have protocol that they would fall back on. And that goes to the reasonability of their actions. Here, for example, appellant could have been the suspect. He could have been a victim of a crime. He could have been an investigation for a suicide, all of which would require CID to properly maintain evidence in a forensically sound manner. Additionally, CID did not fall solely on protocol when they did that. The first move the agent made was a manual review of the phone. And as trial defense counsel grilled him at the hearing before the military judge, she asked him, isn't it true that that manual manipulation of the phone could affect the metadata, which would later potentially hinder or deter the forensic examiner from looking at the metadata and determining the last use of the phone? So all of that would go to the reasonability of how CID was acting in that very moment. And they fell back on their training, which is what law enforcement should do. And they should be following their protocol. I think this court would agree with that basic premise. So when they did put it in airplane mode and transport it, I'd also like to point out the timeline here, which is reflected in these AIRs that I just mentioned. This did not go to an evidence room and sit for several hours. The CID entered the premises at the request of who had a very genuine belief that, quote, The appellant was a very real risk for suicide. That was his primary concern. And that can be seen from 06, from the moment appellant did not check in at CQ, to approximately 1300 when he pleaded with CID for the second time now to get involved and help him locate appellant. When CID did eventually get involved to help locate appellant around 1300, they sent several agents to try to enter the premises. Several agents went to his last known whereabouts at Polo Beach. They entered the premises, and they documented everything they did, which was to include locating the phone at 1423. At 1423, does the manual review of the phone and then puts it on airplane mode and transports it to a DFE because he can no longer provide any, other than the manual search of the videos, which he determined did not provide any immediate evidence as to the appellant's location. He said, hey, maybe the DFE can find more information by compiling all this information using Cellbrite in an easy and analytical manner, as opposed to me where I look through the videos and then I move to a different application and look through here. What he can do with Cellbrite is he can put all of that information into the most recent activity, which is exactly what he did here when he located the CSAM that was found in the same window pane and next to the suicide videos that he was using as a last means of signs of life. So when we look at all of those factors in totality, Your Honor, it suggests that law enforcement was acting reasonably and in good faith to save appellant. Additionally, and as the ACCA found here and as the military judge found at trial, there was also a lawful consent. And the government respectfully disagrees with my colleague on the other side of the aisle that there was not at least a good faith or a – it was not an abuse of discretion for a military judge to find that common authority existed over the cell phone. And a variety of factors support that finding that were reasonably supported by the record. To include, for example, the phone was in the premises that they shared. These are spouses. They are not roommates, such as Rader. They are not colleagues, such as United States v. Black. They were not roommates who had lived together for 2 weeks, such as United States v. White. Much more akin to United States v. Eugene, these were spouses who lived together and shared the premises. And as this Court, I'm sure, is well aware, in United States v. Eugene, whether there was common authority over the cell phone in that case was not even questioned. And as this Court has said in United States v. Weston, items that are reasonably within the confines of the home and not set apart or reasonably set apart showing exclusive third-party control are part of the common authority of the home. Granted, here, this phone was set apart initially. However, by divulging the secret location, the secret passcode, and that there were cryptic messages relating to the potential whereabouts or what happened to appellant, all of that now pulled it away from this exclusive third-party control and put it back into the common authority of appellant's husband. And therefore, when the government relied, when CID relied on his common authority, they acted reasonably, and that objective standard, rather than a subjective standard, which my colleague would like this Court to apply, is what this Court should look to, and that's supported by Supreme Court precedent.
Captain Scarpati.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which of these is the stronger of your arguments, the actual authority or the fact that the investigators had thought that the husband had authority, in other words, apparent authority? I mean, do you have to prevail on actual authority?
No, Your Honor. And I think the answer is probably always apparent authority, because if this Court does find that there was not actual authority, which would not be unreasonable, the government believes that the judge clearly did not abuse his discretion in making that finding, but of course the Court could find that. It was definitely apparent authority based on those factors that I just listed. And this Court would, again, look to good faith when you determine apparent authority.
So is that the linchpin or the one point that you and Mr. Cacera basically disagree on as far as is it this good faith issue? In other words, he doesn't think, and nor did the dissenting judge at the CCA think, that there was good faith here. Is that the point where the two of you have the most disagreement?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think, to be fair, the only way that you could get to finding these assumptions of bad faith would be taking facts on the record that are otherwise not directly, they are circumstantial, and essentially applying that with the lens that CID was acting under this subterfuge. But when you look at the totality of the circumstances and everything that law enforcement was doing, that is the government believes, an unfair characterization, and certainly when you look at it through the lens of whether the military judge abused his discretion in finding that law enforcement was acting in good faith.
Thank you.
Counsel, one of the facts that your colleagues have pointed out as being hard to reconcile with the record is the military judge's determination that the vacuum phone was the everyday or primary phone. And so let's say that we agree with them and we think that's just clearly erroneous, that the military had the appellant's primary phone in their possession, right? What difference does that make to our analysis?
Firstly, Your Honor, I'd point out that if you read the military judge's ruling on that specific paragraph, he states that once his phone was seized, this appeared to be the phone that he was using, and therefore it became his primary phone. I don't think that the military judge's words could fairly be characterized as, hey, this was his everyday phone before his phone was seized. Secondly, I'd point out that this phone was one of many old devices that existed within the house. And if you look at the AIRs, the husband says, hey, go to the house. There's a phone here under the nightstand. There's a phone here that used to be appellant's. There's a laptop. There's USB devices. And he says, look, you know, whatever you need to do, there's all these old devices. So from the appearance of all of that, CID, all they know is we know for a fact this is the last device he used. CID doesn't go looking through all the old devices under the emergency exception. They just look through this one phone that appellant had stated, I left you this phone, and there's this cryptic message on there, and it has something important to tell you. So I would also point out that going back to the disregard and versus disallow, that appellant takes a lot of different actions that would suggest he or laid out a large plan for his husband to follow. Not all the aspects of that plan were left in place. The keys were not on the nightstand. The car was not at Polo Beach. But what did remain was the phone in that same location. And what did remain was appellant disappeared just as he suggested that he would. And the passcode was there. And as CID found it, the passcode was not even, it was open when they did find it. Lastly, on this point, Your Honor, before I move on to the second issue, I would just point out that even if this court found that the military judge did abuse his discretion in finding that the emergency and the consent exceptions did apply, exclusion would not have been the appropriate remedy. And the reason for that is exclusion is a cost-benefit analysis. That is the benefit of excluding the evidence outweighed by the cost of allowing it in? Here, the cost would have been appellant's life. CID, the commander, and Honolulu PD all worked together to actually save the appellant from the exact plan that they suggested. That's based on finding the Benadryl receipts, based on his disappearance, based on his suicide videos, and those joint efforts, because it was who called CID who recommended to follow a police report with Honolulu PD, and eventually appellant who called Honolulu PD to report a simple theft, which resulted in Honolulu PD, and this was at 2350 at night, Your Honor, I'll point out, to result in Honolulu PD eventually going to these premises, recognizing that appellant was a missing person and rendering life-saving aid as he was in kidney failure from overdosing on Benadryl. So ultimately, that even if this court found that those exceptions did not apply, exclusion would not have been warranted. Moving on to the first assignment of error, whether the military judge abuses discretion in denying defense's motion for recusal. I'd point out this court's precedent under United States v. Quintilla, that there's a strong presumption that a judge is impartial, and there's a strong presumption under United States v. Erickson that a military judge knows and follows the law absent evidence to the contrary. Here, what my colleague is essentially asking this court to do is to find a per se rule that where someone is an SVP in the same jurisdiction or they have worked with both trial and defense counsel, I'll point out, of that court-martial, then they are per se disqualified based on the appearance of bias. The government would point out that the rest of those factors this court should consider even under the appearance of bias. Just as the military judge professed that he was the special victim prosecutor, which inherently, as I'm sure this court is well aware, would include the title of being a subject matter expert in special victim crimes, he also stated that he sectioned himself off in anticipation of this role as military judge. A member of the public and going to your question, Judge Olson, a member of the public is not necessarily a member of the military public. It's a member of the public generally. And to your question, Your Honor, yes, I think it is a fair consideration that many members of the public who are familiar with the judicial system would know that people become prosecutors, defense attorneys. They may become the district attorney, and then they may be elected or appointed as a judge, and it's usually in that same jurisdiction. That is the norm. The military, which – and this is all under a due process. This is all under the Constitution of the United States, a due process right. So we're not talking about a specific military right that appellant is entitled to. We're talking about a basic constitutional right and the same right that other members of the public would be entitled to. So to say that in the military, you have to change jobs before you can become a military judge, the government does not believe that that would be necessary to maintain.
Captain Scarpati, Mr. Casera also mentions that one of the points of concern is this mentoring that this particular judge did prior to becoming a military judge. But who was being mentored and what was the nature of the mentoring?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll point out that in appellant's reply brief, they mentioned that, hey, this was just one line in our original brief, and government spends entirely too much time talking about it in our brief. But to the extent that he does believe that's a strong argument for him, I would point out that both trial counsel, the prosecutors, and the defense attorney were all either an MJA, a trial counsel, or an SVC, which an SVC, I believe in that case, he's not working directly under. He's working as a separate entity. He's working as on behalf of the victim. So he may have had an interrelated role with the SVP, but he was not working under. He was the military justice advisor. So she, again, it's like a junior prosecutor. And then I forget the lead trial counsel's name, but he was a trial counsel and would have been working likely directly with the SVP. The nature of the mentoring was nothing more than basic maybe some trainings or LPDs or something to that effect and working with generally. And as this court points out, United States v. Butcher, that is extremely common and not something that, absent some extraordinary circumstances, should be looked at as a disqualifying point. And I'd point to Judge Maggs's concurrence in United States v. Uribe, in which Judge Maggs stated that there's just as much of a duty to stay on a case where you are not disqualified as there is to take yourself off a case where you are disqualified. These facts of this case are far different from, for example, United States v. Uribe, where there was an intimate personal relationship between the military judge and the lead prosecutor in that case, so much so that he attended his bachelor party and was there for the birth of his wife. Here we're talking about normal, everyday work occurrences, completely different set of circumstances.
Counsel, can you address the point that appellant makes in the reply brief about Keiki Shield, that the military judge knew details about the undercover operation which the public, that no one in the public could know, that were unknown, that nobody could know, and that this is just information that the military judge has, and somebody looking at this would say, seems kind of suspicious here.
Yes, Your Honor. So I would point out that that's not in the record. That he had details of the operation that no other person would have. What is in the record is that he was familiar with Operation OK Key Shield based on his role as an SVP. Whether he knew the agents who were still working in that jurisdiction on this particular operation, or whether they were testifying in this court-martial, or whether there were some nuanced techniques that were used in these sting operations that he knew of, that no one else knew of, is not part of the record. And I would point out just that the common understanding of a sting operation is common knowledge. And I'd point to, for example, To Catch a Predator, a common TV show in which there are circumstances in which someone is set up in a sting operation. So whether his knowledge was as basic as, hey, I've worked on these operations before, or I've loosely seen them in criminal investigations, or whether he was intimately involved, that's not part of the record, and therefore is not before this court to determine whether he abused his discretion in denying the motion for recusal. Lastly, I would just say, Your Honor, that even if this court found he did abuse his discretion, that the Liljeburg factors would not warrant dismissal of this case. And as this case court stated in the United States v. Uribe, even when there is an abuse of discretion, for example, a strongly worded opinion saying, hey, we should be careful about this in the future, can have just as much of a deterring effect as could reversing a case, if not more so. But here, specifically, the evidence on the government's case was very strong. For example, appellant was caught red-handed in a sting operation with a phone full of text messages that incriminated himself. His phone was found with CSAM on it, and there was suicide videos that made admissions as to all of this evidence as well. So the evidence here was overwhelming that supported appellant's guilt. Additionally, as the court pointed out in United States v. Uribe, the military judge acquitted appellant of one of the offenses here. He did not rule with unanimity on behalf of the government, and he otherwise made reasonable determinations. And therefore, the prejudice factors under United States v. Liljeburg would not warrant reversal in this case.
Well, counsel, the appellant argues not so much factors one and two, but the whole public perception, and that and this goes back to the kind of career progression and what would the general public think of having a judge who, because of primacy and recency, would be familiar, self-professed experts of the magic expert in the area, in the same jurisdiction, and was immediately prior to him ascending the bench. That government's position is that is in no way going to be affecting the public perception of impartiality.
I would say, Your Honor, if you looked at those facts in a vacuum, then perhaps. However, here, Your Honor, the totality of the circumstances would not suggest to the members of the public that appellant had an unfair trial. And that I would reflect again on all of the facts that I mentioned about him sectioning himself off, having no relation with this case, not ruling in unanimity with the government, acquitting appellant of one of the offenses, and also just the fact that there's no actual bias here that appellant points to or no clear erroneous reliance on the law. I see my time has expired.
See no further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. This Court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, Captain Scarpati. Mr. Casera.
Your Honors, I would like to talk about two themes that my extremely learned colleague discussed. And when he came up here today, I thought, well, they're bringing in their heavy hitters. I think Captain Scarpati is a great arguer. And that is, A, as it relates to assignment of error, one, whether or not we are requesting a per se rule that a military judge who has had that particular career track would be disqualified. And two, as it relates to assignment of error, two, his comment that, well, they're still cops, so this is what they had to do. I'll start with assignment of error, one. As I said, I think it'd be wonderful if the trial judiciary came out with a per se rule that says, under the facts of, you know, this case, don't do this. That's not what I'm asking this court to do. And indeed, I don't believe that this court should do that. I believe that that would be, as the common parlance says, legislating from the bench. What I think this court should do is to say, even in the military judge's own words, he said, this is not one of the cases in OKC that I worked on. Well, clearly that means that he worked on other cases in OKC. So if we take the military judge at his word that he was the subject matter expert, that he mentored these trial counsel, that he was the special victims prosecutor in this particular jurisdiction in the time right before this court-martial and while these crimes took place, but this is not one of the ones that I worked on, not one of the OKC cases that I worked on, that would cause a reasonable member of the public to believe that this case was unfairly tried and that the military judge was not impartial. As we look to the assignment of error two, the comment that these are still law enforcement, and Judge Hardy, Chief Judge, you don't probably remember this, but you and I had an argument one time in which you said that should scare every member of the public as it related to the scope of a government search. The fact that these cops were still cops and therefore they have to put the phone in a forensic analysis mode should scare any teenager's mom who has run away from base. Because the first thing that cops are going to do is to put the phone into an airplane mode which means that if my frantic son calls me or if a frantic soldier calls me, that he's not going to be able to reach me. The other point as it relates to assignment of error two is that the government says, well, he missed a sign-in. Respectfully, he had signed in, he had emailed his commander or texted his commander and said, and his commander had said, hey, thank you for keeping me in touch. He missed one sign-in. So if we are going to discuss the possibility of per se rules, if the government is requesting a per se rule that any time a soldier misses a sign-in on a day when he happened to be on leave, that the police can go to his house and go through his telephone without any search authorization, that should scare every member of the general public. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Cassara.
Thank you, Judge.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.